Lewis's thrust in the space trilogy is less that the given natures of things are beyond the reach of our will, and more the given natures of things are so to be celebrated, rejoiced in, and wondered at, only a fool would want to make them subject, or even dream that he could make them subject to his will. You wouldn't change a thing that you dearly loved. Hello. We're back today to discuss C.S. Lewis's Space Trilogy, as it is often called, although the trilogy of novels he wrote in the 30s and 40s, sometimes called the Cosmic Trilogy or the Ransom Trilogy after its protagonist, Elwin Ransom. In fact, there are reasons to decline to refer to it as a space trilogy, reasons we'll encounter in just a few moments. But most people refer to it as the space trilogy quite comfortably, and that is how I will refer to it here. This trilogy of novels by Lewis consists of Out of the Silent Planet, Perelandra, and That Hideous Strength. And as I say, he started publishing these in the late 30s and through the mid-40s. And these precede his Chronicles of Narnia. In a preceding lecture, I discussed some of the general features and thematic underlying elements in the Chronicles of Narnia, and I will do the same here with the Space Trilogy. Lewis did write other fiction. Till We Have Faces is a remarkable novel, and many of Lewis's avid readers regard Till We Have Faces as his greatest novel. It doesn't have the same kind of reputation or wide readership as these novels, however, so I chose to talk about these in discussing Lewis's fiction. But it deserves reading as well, and I highly encourage it. Also, with respect to the Chronicles of Narnia, I would encourage readers to read around the Chronicles as well. Dr. Michael Ward, who presented some of the lectures in this series, has written a remarkable book, Planet Narnia. He probably was too much a gentleman to plug his own book in his lectures, so I will mention that book here in mine. He knows more about Narnia than he's forgotten more about Narnia than I have ever learned. So highly recommend that book. But there are other good things written about C.S. Lewis and his fiction as well, and it's worth reading around. Reading the novels, of course, is most important, but reading around them as well should be done. But as I say, the Space Trilogy preceded the Chronicles of Narnia in their writing and publishing. But his fundamental purpose is present in these novels as well, and that is the rehabilitation of the imagination. Lewis is interested in telling stories. He's interested in making certain kinds of points, although those points arise out of the dynamic, the moral dynamism of those stories themselves. It's not a moral overlay, but behind all of that is his wish to tell stories, a kind of story, and to tell a story in a kind of way that adjusts or moves our imaginations off the kind of center that they presently rest upon, a center that really constitutes a rut. So while the Narnia tales establish a set of alternate worlds in which to watch their moral tests and crises play out. In this set of books, the Space Trilogy, we see these things working within the planets of our own cosmos. And in this cosmos, as thought by the character named Lewis in Perelandra, the distinction, this character, this is a quote from Perelandra, and a man Lewis says, the distinction between natural and supernatural, in fact, broke down. The character is reflecting on some things that had happened to Elwin Ransom and was things that were happening in the cosmos more generally. The distinction between the supernatural and the natural had broken down. And when it had done so, one realized how great a comfort it had been, how it had eased, that is, how the separation of supernatural and natural had eased the burden of intolerable strangeness which this universe imposes on us by dividing it into two halves and encouraging the mind never to think of both in the same context. That is, this character Lewis thinking about Elwyn Ransom and his cosmic experience in our solar system says the merging of the natural and the supernatural had occurred, and this is a troublesome merge. By troublesome, he means troublesome in a good way. We had conveniently separated, distinguished the natural and the supernatural and placed them in little non-communicating boxes. Okay, now I'm just doing the natural world. Now I'm doing a religion or the supernatural world, and never the twain shall meet. Well, in the space trilogy, those two very much meet. Nature and supernature fold into each other without, however, losing their own particular characteristics. So the moral drama implicit in this union of supernatural and natural is in the series brought forcefully into our universe and even into our planet, into our nation, into our neighborhood, and ultimately even into the homes that populate the novel, That Hideous Strength. So the series also, as did Narnia, the series illuminates given realities, realities that are adum, realities that are gratuitously given to us. And it does so with remarkable prescience, but particularly it does so with respect to the sexes, with respect to male and female, masculine and feminine. These are in high focus in the space trilogy in ways that are often very, very surprising. And speaking of surprising, this is in fact one of the primary techniques of the novels to begin with. In some ways, you might say the trilogy attempts to recondition the way that we look at the world by making, as the old saying goes, the strange familiar and the familiar strange. In other words, surprising. Lewis isn't trying to surprise for its own sake. He's trying to surprise for an aesthetic and intellectual and moral purpose. But this business of making the familiar strange and the strange familiar is, once again, as we saw in some of the Narnia tales, an attempt to reawaken us or make us susceptible again to the phenomenon of wonder. Now, I should add that this phrase, making the familiar strange and the strange familiar, is usually associated with the Romantics. And when I say Romantics, I don't mean candlelight dinner for two. I mean those thinkers and poets and artists, say, between the latter half of the 18th century up through the first half of the 19th century. They're understood to be trying to instill in the commonplace a sense of mystery and the unusual. People very often regard this as a sort of false indulgence of the imagination. But I think it's true in Lewis's case, and in fact it was true in many of the Romantics, that they're trying to nudge the imagination. It's that business of default settings. We tend to approach things in certain ways. We're in a kind of rut of materialism. We tend to look at the world as just stuff that's out there. More about this in a few minutes. And so we need to inject our perceptions of things with a new sense of their strangeness and their mystery. Perhaps I should give you an example. In the novels in this trilogy, the most immediate example of this, and I think a very important thematic one as well, is to introduce a pre-modern conception of what is around the world to begin with. By around the world, I mean off the planet Earth. What's out there in the cosmos? And Lewis makes the point repeatedly and emphatically, especially in Out of the Silent Planet, that the cosmos is not space. It is the heavens. There's a fundamental different default, again, in thinking of the cosmos as a heavens rather than an empty, cold vacuum. We, of course, as part of our scientific endowment, regard the cosmos as a temperature-less emptiness. It is a vacuum. It is cold. It is, frankly, the result of fascinating, maybe even beautiful, but terrible accidents. The cosmos is itself, without inherent meaning. It can be appreciated perhaps for its beauty, but not for its significance, because there is no signification in the cosmos other than things are. They are by accident, and what they are is a is a matter of mere coincidence. What the cosmos is simply a feature of its composition, its material composition. Lewis restores in his trilogy the notion of the cosmos as a heavens. The cosmos is a peopled place, not literally with human beings perhaps, but it's filled with intelligences and life and vitality and liveliness. It is a plenum, not a vacuum. It's full. Out there beyond the earth, we have what he calls sweet influences. He even invokes the old tradition of astrology, where the stars exercise influences upon us, not so much in a deterministic way, but in a kind of affective way. The stars influence is sweet. There in the cosmos is warmth, there is life, and the invigorating presence of intelligence. Elwin Ransom, as he's being taken to Malacandra, which is Mars, in that first novel, feels a kind of buoyance and intensification of life while he's in outer space. So the word space is not even the appropriate term in this case. And this is, by the way, why people sometimes object to the term space trilogy. It's not a space. It's a cosmic trilogy. Cosmos means order, and there's order and life and vitality out there, not coldness and emptiness. So this is an example again of rendering the familiar strange. We're familiar and comfortable with a cold cosmos. Well, we're kind of freaked out by a cosmos that is filled with intelligences and influences. Even if it's a rather benevolent kind of influence, we're taken off our comfortable center, as it were. Ransom says, already it had become impossible to think of it as space. He could not feel that they were on an island of life, journeying through an abyss of death. That is, when he's in his spaceship. It's not an island of life journeying through an abyss of death. He felt almost the opposite, that life was waiting outside the little iron eggshell in which they rode, ready to break in, and that if it killed them, it would kill them by excess of its vitality. Well, another way that Lewis attempts to render the familiar strange is through a series of what I will rather inelegantly call thought experiments. He does this a great deal, in fact, in the trilogy. He will take up something. A couple of us, just a few minutes ago, were talking about this. He'll take up something and get really quite caught up in the novelty and the strangeness of it, and he'll spend pages detailing it. You know, let's talk about how islands float and how that would work, and how would you scramble, if you were swimming in that sea, how would you scramble on top of a floating island, especially given its movement, and what would the texture be of the tubule-like roots that penetrate this floating island and perhaps into the water itself. He really does get caught up in many of the details, but the thought experiments I'm referring to have to do with often things a little bit more significant, a little bit more of a burden. I don't mean that in a negative sense. A little bit more of a burden on the purpose and meaning of the novels. So, for instance, on Malacandra, on Mars, Lewis creates multiple rational species occupying the same planet. These species, any kind of rational being, is called a Neu, H-N-A-U, Neu. There are three Neu on Malacandra, the Hrosa, the Saroni, and the here we go. I will attempt to say this. I think it was written not to be said. I think Lewis is just throwing a curveball at us, but I'll take the challenge. The Pfiffeltrig. Try it at home. Or maybe I should say, don't try this at home, children. Anyway, these three species, Hrossa, Saroni, and Pfiffeltrig, pardon me if I spat, are very, very different. They have unique characteristics, and Lewis loves detailing their qualities. The Hrossa are, I know this is crude, but an unsophisticated summary, but they're seal-like creatures, very tall, very large, but they're seal-like creatures. And they are, I think of them as Homeric. They're poetic and they're heroic. They love battle and heroism and martial valor, even though the only thing there is to fight is this other sort of sea creature on the island, I'm sorry, on the planet. But they love to go fight these sea creatures and then come back and write poems and sing songs about them. It's just it's very literary, very poetic, and Ellen Ransom learns the old solar language with them and comes to be most fond of them in certain respects. The Saroni, the philosophers, scholars, and historians of the planet, and the Pfiffeltrig are the craftsmen, the technicians. They're the builders. So the thought experiment in this case is not just creating an alien species, but creating three of them, putting them together, having them sort of interact with each other, and interact relatively benevolently, but have or be possessed of very different natures and very, very different characters. Related to that thought experiment, what would that be like? To have those three Hneu. Related to that is the fact that this is, people might argue with me about this, but that's okay. Argument is fun. It's a prelapsarian world. Malacandra hasn't suffered a kind of moral collapse, a moral calamity, an aboriginal moral disaster the way Earth has suffered. The Hrossa, Saroni, and Pfiffeltrig, you don't find murder, you don't find theft and mayhem, you don't find envy and bitterness and lust. It's a world of great moral tranquility and elevation. What would that look like? See, that's a thought experiment, right? What would it look like, a prelapse? How would things work? Especially if they had to, if you introduced into that world a fallen creature, man, Ellen Ransom and his, shall we say, a little bit more fallen colleagues, Weston and Divine. In Out of the Silent Planet in particular, there is a lot of description and relatively little plot. And he's interested in the interactions of these fallen and non-fallen beings and asks, what would for the unfallen beings, society look like? What would their families look like? How would they relate to the spiritual world? Maladil is God or the son of God. There's a god called the Old Father and then the son of God, Maladil, who is, by the way, the creator of the worlds as well, clear reference to the Christian understanding. But again, how would such unfallen beings die? How would death be experienced? Would it be a traumatic, calamitous event, or would it be characterized by some kind of peaceful transition? How would families come into being? And then perhaps very interestingly, would there be such a thing as danger? And if so, how would that work in an unfallen, prelapsarian context? There are certain pleasures, there are certain delights that come from the confrontation with danger. Would an Edenic, as it were, world be without those delights? Would an entire species of delight have no image in a pre-Lapsarian world? By the way, some of these Lapsarian interests, when Lewis is writing these novels, he was also working a lot on John Milton and Paradise Lost in particular. So you can see some of his scholarship getting in and influencing some of his fiction as well. So these thought experiments, as I say, are part of his, I think they're fascinating to him for their own sake, but they are also part of his attempt to render the strange familiar. By the time we leave Malacandra, we're actually quite happily familiar with beings that just 50 pages earlier, say, were extraordinarily bizarre and strange. Well, in the first two novels, the villain Weston appears and represents two very powerful and different forms of idolatrous self-conceit. I'm moving on to look a little bit at Perelandra, the second novel in the series now. So in the first novel, Weston is the villain, and he is the voice, Lewis calls him, of solemn scientific idealism. He expresses a kind of crude, there in the first novel, he expresses a crude utilitarian desire to master and consume the entire universe, planet by planet, if necessary. Weston is a brilliant award-winning physicist, and he's invented this means of interplanetary travel. And he wants to do this travel, not primarily for the pursuit of more knowledge or understanding of physics, but for the perpetuation of the human species indefinitely. He thinks that endowing man with these interplanetary powers and travel will permit the furthest reaches of man's evolution and domination of the universe. This same man, however, has undergone a kind of, shall we say, conversion, because he reappears in the second novel, in Perelandra, reappears as one who has rejected his earlier views and has risen to a profoundly dangerous and false pseudo-spirituality. Now, that is in Perelandra, Weston embraces a syncretistic universalism that effectively identifies the self, with the life force of the universe. It blends all forms of being into one. Now, this is very interesting. Lewis has an interest. I mentioned when talking about the Chronicles of Narnia that Lewis is very interested in synthesis and the integration of things as a habit of mind quite out of favor in a scientific, analytical modern age. Lewis wants to reintroduce and revalorize, as they say, the habits of mind of synthesis and connection. But those habits are prone to a kind of wild excess. And what he had done earlier in Perelandra through Weston is depicted a kind of synthesis that is not synthesis at all, but syncretistic, that is, a dissolving of things into each other, not a unification, but a dissolution. So again, in his syncretism, all forms of being are blended into a pantheistic self. He rejects, quote, old dualisms, and he howls at Ransom, quoting Weston now, "There is no possible distinction in concrete thought between me and the universe." And by the way, if this sounds pompous, extreme, and outrageous, it's meant to. "Insofar as I am the conductor of the central forward pressure of the universe," I like that phrase, central forward pressure is what he says where we simply use the word progressive. "The central forward pressure of the universe, I am it. Do you see, you timid, scruple-mongering fool?" He's talking to Ransom. They've been arguing. "I am the universe. I, Weston, am your god and your devil. I call that force into me completely." Now, again, I'm assuming all of you have read the novel, and that moment you probably recall is when the devil takes complete possession of Weston. Weston goes into something. Ransom thinks it's a sort of seizure, but later he realized that Weston has actually been possessed, taken possession of by malevolent spiritual forces intent on perpetuating the fall that occurred on Earth throughout our solar system, our cosmos. Weston is to act then as the serpent in the Garden of Eden, except this is not Eden, it's Perelandra, or what we call Venus, where another creation has begun, and there is a new Eve named Tenedril, and she, again, is to be subject to temptation. Weston is the vehicle of that temptation. He is the arguing serpent. Now, the temptation, all of Perelandra, well, that's not strictly true, much of Perelandra is an account of Weston's attempt to get Tenedril to fall, to sin, to violate the one command. Again, Genesis, and there is a single command in this new Garden of Eden, and that is that Tenedril and her mate, Tor, her husband, are not to sleep on the fixed lands. Perelandra, as you recall, is an ocean world, and islands float on this ocean. But there is one – actually, there are two, but we'll for the moment, we'll just say there is this one fixed land, and she must not – they must not sleep, spend the night on – they can visit that land, but they can't spend the night. So Weston's entire effort is to try to get her to go and spend the night on that fixed land, simply in order to, again, violate the decree of God of Maladil. The temptations are fascinating. They are an exercise in highly – sophisticated and even tortured sophistry. Weston uses many brilliant and dashing arguments to try to get Tenedril, this unfallen being. This, by the way, has part of the character, that thought experiment business that I mentioned. How do you get a sort of unfallen, perfect being? How do you get that being to imperfect itself? And the answer is fascinating. Ransom is watching all this unfold and arguing against Weston and acting as the good angel, as it were, on the shoulder of Tenedril, and Weston's the bad angel on the other shoulder, arguing that she should violate the decree of Maladil. Ransom attempts to refute him. But Weston has all the intelligence of a fallen Eldil. An Eldil is a kind of angel, an angelic creature. And we know, of course, we recognize the allusions to Satan in our own understanding. Very smart, brilliant, can out-argue or, shall we say, out-sophistry anyone, anytime. And this is what he does. However, the most potent mode of temptation turns out not to be the sophistical reasonings of Weston. It is, as Ransom recognizes, it is rather through the shaping power of stories on the imagination. And remember what I said about the imagination. You're probably getting sick of hearing about it. But in fact, what happens as the temptations continue is that Weston gives up sophistic argument and moves to poetry, or rather to storytelling. And he does so because what he wants to do is change the way she, Tenedril, thinks about the world. It's those default settings, so to speak. He wants her to lose her receptivity to what is actually real, including the reality of the decree of Maladil. Do not sleep on the fixed lands. What Lewis is brilliant. What he's showing here is that in certain ways, the imagination is more morally potent even than a reason subject to folly and error and sophistry. The imagination is even more dangerously subject to misconstruction, doing certain things we'll talk about in a second. You can cloud the imagination and render it obtuse, render it insusceptible to what is actual and real. With enough poetic coloring, in other words, Weston can weaken the force of reality on her imagination. And this, in the novel, this same coloration, as you know, comes dangerously close to succeeding. What he does is, you recall, he suggests to her that violating the command will actually render her heroic, noble, a tragic queen of this new planet, okay? And what's interesting about this isn't just the sort of vanity implicit in the, wouldn't I be great as a tragic queen, but rather Lewis points out the theatricality of it. What Weston does is he tries to introduce a kind of self-consciousness that can pervert and skew the imagination and turn us into self-regarding beings. And what I mean by that is he actually uses a mirror. He actually gets her to look at herself. It's symbolically very, very appropriate, very fitting. What he wants to get her to do is to look at herself as if she is not being herself, but look at herself from outside of herself in a kind of self-conscious way that allows her to start acting rather than being. Okay? Theatricality. The 20th century, by the way, many great authors in the 20th century are fascinated by a kind of hyper-self-consciousness that seems to afflict the modern age in particular. And Lewis identifies that as a potent way of corrupting the imagination and leading it to fall. Well, Perelandra, you read the story, I trust, so you know that indeed she does not fall. Ransom has more work to do than merely argue, and he acts as a kind of ransom, so to speak, for her and for her husband, Tor, and Venus or Perelandra remains unfallen. But an important facet of this entire Perelandra drama has nothing to do, or not immediately anything to do, with this business of temptation and a danger and the danger of a fall, but rather a dualism. It presents a dualism that Lewis says is built into the very fabric of reality itself, this business I mentioned of masculine and feminine. Sex, gender, the proper term is sex, by the way. Gender, I think I'm a little old-fashioned. I'd rather use gender as applied to language. It's not really properly used with respect to maleness and femaleness. It's a linguistic and grammatical category, not a human one. The proper term for people is sex. Sex and the nature of man and woman, fecundity, you know, fertility, family, children. This is at the very heart of the entire trilogy, not just Perelandra, but we see it with a particular emphasis in Perelandra. There's even more emphasis later in That Hideous Strength, but we see it first in a kind of clarity here in Perelandra. It's more than a theme, this business of sex. It's a bedrock reality to which Lewis appeals in attempts to restore our susceptibility to what is real. Especially important, this is especially important in a technological and scientific age where we, human beings, appear to have overmastered realities one by one, such that no fundamental given nature need be regarded as beyond the reach of our will. That's really what Lewis is after in the entire trilogy, to restore sensitivity to the given nature such that it is understood to be beyond the reach of our will. Now, the final volume of the trilogy, That Hideous Strength, is also the most extended, and interestingly, it occurs here on Earth, though it involves beings that Ransom came to know on some of those other planets. Its depiction of a nightmarish government agency called, ironically, NICE, the National Institute for Coordinated Experiments, NICE. You'll never use the word NICE. Once you read the novel, again, I trust you read the novel, but you probably don't use the word NICE without thinking a little ironically about it after reading this. It's a satirical but grim representation of institutionalized bureaucratic pseudoscience reaching into dark spiritual territory for despotic control of society. Or rather, it's the reverse. It's really the reaching of dark spiritual territory into pseudoscience in order to achieve a despotic control of the earth, of the world. Lewis once remarked about this very thing, "What we are obviously up against throughout the story, that is, That Hideous Strength, is not scientists, but officials. If anyone ought to feel himself libeled by this book, it is not the scientist, but the civil servant. And next to the civil servant, certain philosophers. Science, however, is used by these officials as a tool." Lewis adds, "Under modern conditions, any effective invitation to hell will certainly appear under the guise of scientific planning, as Hitler's regime, in fact, did." So in this way, human society and culture is looked upon as a purely and merely material phenomenon to be manipulated, to be controlled, to be conquered, as nature is conquered and controlled by the application of scientific expertise. Somebody once told me, I've never chased this down, but somebody once told me that Bertrand Russell said, the purpose of science is to make nature sit up and beg. Whether he said it or not, I don't know, but certainly that's the spirit behind the NICE, N-I-C-E, this National Institute of Coordinated Experiments. But again, it's pseudoscience. It's not real science, and it's this pseudoscience drafted, as it were, by a bureaucratic administration that seeks despotic control. Now, this is not to say that those opposed to NICE are mere rugged individualists for whom personal independence is everything. There's a war, of course, in the novel, but the people opposed, you notice that the people opposed to NICE are not just sort of individualists. In fact, the rugged individualist in the novel is held up for some criticism for this. Jane Studdock prizes a kind of sterile autonomy, and she resents in the novel any suggestion that she has duties and responsibilities to others, or even to her own nature, duties and responsibilities that are apart from or perhaps above her own will. So you see, you've got the despotic tendencies of NICE, a bureaucratic, administrative, pseudoscientific tyranny, and over and against that you have its opponents, but you also have another error, as it were, and that is this radical and sterile, I use the word advisedly, autonomous individual. Okay, there's something else. The good, the opponents that are the good, represent something that involves more. Frankly, it's the family. It represents a kind of small community of people united by their love and their duty to each other and their duty to their own natures. So one of the most important themes in the novel, and as I said, in the trilogy, is the transcending importance of one's own nature and relationships to others over and above any kind of radically autonomous will. And we see this as represented by Venus, Perelandra, now not the not the planet Venus, but by the goddess as or the spirit Venus. And that is the rich vocation of the sexes. This is – Lewis focuses on this startlingly, intensely in That Hideous Strength. That is the rich vocation of the senses, the sexes in a fecund, fertile generosity, a duality of male and female that represents in miniature what he says is a fundamental disposition, masculine and feminine, in reality itself. Now, ultimately, this is the most powerful effort, I think, in the novel of Lewis's to reorient the imagination by appealing to something grounded, something given, something real. What has happened in the world since Lewis died, the sexual revolution and its postscript, probably would have been very hard for Lewis to imagine in detail, but he actually pegged it in its essence. What we tend to think of as sex, and again, by that I mean male and female. What we tend to think of as sex is mere biological arbitrarity and accident, material, consequential only in its, shall we say, unmanaged results, not meaningful in and of itself. Lewis invents in That Hideous Strength, well, actually the trilogy as a whole, but particularly here in this last novel, what I hesitate to call, but I will do it anyway, mythologized sex or gender. And that is, he tries to, again, bring back to the very notion of sex the idea of a warm, rich, meaningful nature. Not just warm, rich experiences with beloved people, but the gendered or sexed nature of male and female is itself replete with meaning. We, in our scientific way, tend to understand sex in a kind of thin, meaningless way that renders it subject to our controlling will. He wants to make sex, maleness and femaleness, an inherent participation in a constituent deep structure of reality itself, and therefore something given, treasured, mysterious, awesome, wonderful. So Lewis brings together Christianity and myth in lots of ways in That Hideous Strength. He blends, it's a mythic romp, if that's not too irreverent. There are Arthurian characters. It refers to the Tower of Babel, classical mythology, and all of these things are ordered within a kind of superintending Christianity that is anything but a dreary old religion. It is presented here as a vibrant, living extension of God himself, an extension into every facet of ordinary life. Again, the modern imagination tends to look at the world as an accidental cosmic hiccup, so to speak, largely devoid of meaning. Lewis calls upon the Western mythic imagination to combat this impoverished view. The strategy, again, of collapsing the natural and the supernatural into each other is meant to awaken wonder in us and to prepare us to see the world as an integrated, meaningful, and moral whole. And the relentless presence of natures, shot through by intelligence and purpose, is meant to tell us, I think, the telos or end, the object that Lewis has in mind as he crafts the trilogy. Beset paradoxically by a combination of blindness to nature and a desire to master it, the modern imagination drifts in a kind of despairing waste. It was made, the imagination, that is, was made for nobler stuff. It is made to see in the nature of things a given reality, replete with meaning and spiritual import. It is made to move us to gratitude and reverence for what we have been made to be. So, if I may say, Lewis, in his fiction, is not so much practicing the apologetics he does in his nonfiction. Rather, he is trying to apply medicine so that the apologetics might have a healthy mind or an imagination to enter into. Or if I could change that figure a little, he is trying to nourish the soil out of which our thinking and reasoning and knowing occurs. It turns out, a world of mystery and wonder is not an unknowable world. Rather, it is the only world in which any genuine knowledge is possible. Thank you.